You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
No,
thanks,
girls who park in cars are not really popular. Not even with the boys they park with.
Welcome to episode 191 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by author Austin Trunick to discuss a 1987 film that earned some awards at the 1987 Cannes Film Festival, but was largely forgotten after that. Starring Barbara Hershey, Jill Clayburgh, and Martha Plimpton, directed by Andrei Konchalovsky, it's... Shy People. But first...
Terry, there's nothing for you to do but tell Mr. Barker about...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream and other good things to eat.
Names of merchants who give dividend tickets are listed in the lobby of the theater and on circulars at the concession stand. Dividend tickets will be accepted on all standard box office priced films. So take a circular with you today. And start saving dividend tickets tomorrow when you shop. See your next movie completely free.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
I'm a man, and I can prove it!
Bluebeard. A man with an eye for beauty, an ear for music, an appreciation for talent. Burton is Bluebeard. He had a way with the world's most beautiful women. He did away with them.
Why did you kill them?
Why else? They deserve to die.
One, he shot. One, he drowned. One, he falconated. One, he froze. One, he chopped. One, he coffined. Two, he chandeliered. Richard Burton as Bluebeard.
Do you like me?
Of course.
Do you love me?
With Raquel Welch.
He was so kind, so gentle,
Verna Lisi.
Oh, lover, when I'm near you.
Natalie Delon. Mary Lou Tolo. Karen Schubert. Sybil Danning. Agostina Belli. And Joey Heatherton.
The great hero, trembling at the thought that his myth might collapse.
Burton. Bluebeard.
Enter the Chamber of Terror. Watch every corner, because this is where the dead become the living. Autopsy. Witness the most unearthly horrors ever performed on the human body.
Don't tell me you get your kids from this stuff. My interest is purely professional. Are you a doctor?
That's right.
Pistol at point blank range, through the throat and upward. For my money, it's a suicide.
You know your corpses, but I know my souls. I confessed this girl only minutes before what you call her suicide.
I don't know anyone more beautiful. And you're trying to destroy her. That's the real crime.
She is the girl who knows more about death than about love. And he is the man who teaches her about both. Someone is driving everyone closer and closer to the grave.
You haven't been passing yourself off as a priest for very long, have you?
I am a priest. You hear me? I am a priest.
Suddenly the fear is spreading, and no dead or living body is safe. Murder goes on a slashing rampage that begins and ends in the morgue.
I'm not the one that's crazy. You are.
Neither God nor exorcism can help you now. Enter, if you dare, the motion picture where death lives at its most terrifying. Autopsy. It'll take you apart.
Can I get a boat to Sullivan Town?
No boat, Sullivan Town.
Oh, there must be a road by now.
No road.
No road?
Nope. No town.
No town?
Never was much of a town, just an old supply store.
Officer, I'm Diana Sullivan. I'm from Cosmopolitan Magazine, and I'm looking for some relatives of mine. Joe Sullivan is my uncle.
Well, I'm sure one of you fine gentlemen will be happy to take Miss Sullivan down the river to meet her kinfolk.
Man, I ain't going all the way back into that mess. Why don't you go, Larry? I don't want to get my head blown off by some old crazy Sullivan.
If you pardon my saying so, man.
They do that stuff? Head blowing off and everything?
Well, now, miss, all the people back in the bayou, Mostly they're Cajun. Peaceful people.
So the stories are exaggerated.
Well, now, ma'am, the Sullivans are among the few who aren't Cajun. It's different. Well, I guess I could say they were a little shy.
Shy? What are you guys talking about?
Well, ma'am, what I mean to say is, they're a little wild. Yeah, that's right.
Well, look, they're my family, for better or for worse. I'd like to see them if I can.
Okay, our movie this time is Shy People from 1987. And joining me to discuss this film is author Austin Chernick. Austin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Todd. Thank you. Thank you for asking me to come back. I'm really excited to be here.
It's awesome to have you back. It's wonderful to delve more into the realm of canon films. And I don't know that I could think of a film more different than the one we talked about last time. So this is going to be interesting. Last time we talked about Aladdin, which, was just a wonderful experience. And now this is going to be much different. But before we get too far here, take a moment, remind our listeners about who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name is Austin Chernick, and I am the author of the Canon Film Guide series of books, of which there are currently two available and a third that I am working hard at work to finish up and get out into the world. These cover the films produced by the Canon Group, a film production company, under the leadership of Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus. They were two cousins who came from Israel and took over this failing American production company, and really unleashed so many ninja movies, Chuck Norris movies, breakdancing movies, He-Man and the Masters Universe, Sylvester Stallone's Over the Top, Superman 4. Basically, if you were in a video store any point in the 1980s to early 90s, you probably rented quite a few of their movies. It was probably because the big movie that week was probably not available already rented. I think a lot of people encountered Canon in the video store for the first time.
Yes, but I don't know that I consider it a consolation prize. I mean, when you saw that wonderful Canon logo show up on the screen, you always knew you were in for something interesting. So
absolutely.
Can't argue with that. Well, you answered one of my questions there when you said a third volume was in the works, because I know your latest one took you up to, I think, 87 or so. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so I know that once you get beyond 87, it gets a little dicey for Canon, doesn't it?
It does. The second book, which is the one that covers 387, really covers their peak, their critical success, what little they had, and their box office success, their biggest movies. They really hit some financial troubles, lots of bad investments, lots of overspending on movies that they really shouldn't have. And they basically went broke. And through a lot of maneuvering, a lot of outside investment, they were kind of able to right the ship for a while, but they weren't able to spend $12 million hiring Sylvester Stallone for a movie. The movies they made from that point on were much smaller. I lovingly call it their direct-to-video period. So these weren't things that were going into theaters quite as much. These were a lot of cheaper sequels to movies, or really smaller movies that tended to get overlooked because they didn't get much of a distribution, or the distribution was underdone or botched in some way, like today's movie is one that's kind of been lost to the sands of time. I feel, even though it was rather critically successful at the time, but we'll get into that.
Well, yeah, and I mean, not to jump the gun too much here, but I thought it was really interesting when you brought this one up as a possibility to talk about, because I had never heard of it before, which you did last time on me too. We talked about Aladdin, which I was like, there's a live action Aladdin from the 80s from Canon. I didn't know this. And it was wonderful to experience that. And, of course, doing the Forgotten Filmcast, I mean, part of what keeps me going with this is discovering films that I've never heard of before. As you've gone through and researched canon and all the different, you know, parts of this studio's history. I mean, are you still amazed that, you know, maybe you discover something that you'd never heard of before?
Oh, all the time, all the time. I will be sad when I, at some point, will run out of canon movies. But yeah, there are ones that really catch me by surprise. And in a lot of cases, there are movies that, you know, I've seen them on IMDb. I've seen them listed in places. I've seen advertising in my archives for them. But to actually see these films, I'm waiting, watching eBay, waiting for a screener copy of a movie to show up sometimes that they didn't even end up sending out to a wider release, that it was, you know, it's a copy that has the, you know, coming soon from Canon Video, you know, the screening text across the bottom. And there are ones that I've had to, you know, put my credit card information into a shady German bootleg site and wait 4 months to see if a DVD-R shows up.
Oh, you're a brave man.
Oh, it's scary. I definitely watch my online accounts pretty carefully after that. But I mean, otherwise I wouldn't get, you know, a bootleg DVD of a VHS transfer of a movie with burnt in Greek subtitles, and which is how I watched a movie called Kimura for the second volume. It was really just not available any other way that I could find at the time.
Well, and I know sometimes the, you know, like Canon was notorious for announcing these films and trying to really put some power behind it stuff, and then they never got made. You know, I can remember lots of things hearing announcements about something and they never made. I'm trying to remember, you know, like, I don't know if this was canon or not, but like, I always remember the announcements about that there was going to be a She-Hulk movie with Brigitte Nielsen. And, you know, and they even took publicity photos and the movie never got made. I don't remember if that was canon or not, but, you know, that type of thing. You'd hear announcements about things that never got made.
Yeah, that one wasn't canon, but they did have the rights to Spider-Man and Captain America for the longest time. If anybody wonders why it took so long for Spider-Man to be part of the current DC movies, you know, not its own separate thing, and that's Canon's fault. That was that was them cherry picking the rights to the screen rights to Spider-Man back in 1984 and really not doing anything with it.
Well, we can't be too hard on them. They gave us a lot of other great entertainment, so
absolutely.
Well, let's get on with our movie here today. Like I said, this is one I had never heard of before. This is called Shy People. It's from 1987. I'm going to butcher the director's name here, I'm sure. Directed by Andrei Konchalovsky? Hopefully that's right.
You got it.
Oh, good. My Russian is better than I thought here. Yeah, he's a Russian filmmaker, and he's got a very interesting filmography. Probably the one he's best known for, speaking of Sylvester Stallone, Tango and Cash. Yes. Of course, but he also directed, you know, some other notable films. Another one from Canon, in fact, one that I've heard quite a few people say they think may be the best film Canon ever released, and that is Runaway Train. And then, you know, a few other titles like Maria's Lovers, Duet for One. So, you know, this guy, you know, definitely had his fair share of big movies. Now, this film, it concerns a New York writer named Diana Sullivan, who's played by Jill Clayburgh. She has been working on a series for Cosmopolitan magazine that are these articles, these stories about families and, you know, family lineage and such. So now she's going to do an article about her own family because there is a distant branch of her family that lives in the bayous of Louisiana. So I guess kind of the idea here is to have a story about this successful city woman and having her discover what life is like for her backwoods relatives, something along those lines. Now, Diana has a teenage daughter named Grace, played by Martha Plimpton, and she is into some troubling behavior. She's dabbling in drugs. She is spending a lot of time with an ex of her mother's. It's never completely laid out exactly what that relationship entails, but it doesn't sound too appropriate. So yeah, there's some troubling things going on there, but Diana has, shall we say, a hands-off approach to parenting. So she doesn't really, you know, take the opportunities to try and straighten the course for her daughter. And nevertheless, she decides that it might be a good idea to have Grace come with her on this trip down to Louisiana. So they head down to the swamps, and when they get there, they have to recruit a collection of local characters to take them on a boat out further into the swamp to the homestead of the Louisiana Sullivans. Yeah, even the locals there are a bit standoffish when it comes to this family. They say, well, they're shy people. That's where the title comes from. Now, once they're there, Diana meets her distant cousin, Ruth, who's played by Barbara Hershey. Ruth is quite young for having three adult sons. She basically married the patriarch of the family, Joe, and you know, he's gone now, but she's there with her three adult sons, and they are interesting characters. You know, basically you've got one that is kept locked up in the shed. There is one that is mentally unstable. And then there is one who is married with a kid on the way. He's played by Patrick Swayze's brother, Don Swayze. And his wife is played by Mare Winningham. And then there's also an estranged fourth brother played by Mare Buttrick, who runs a strip club in the nearest small town. And he's basically considered dead by his mother and the rest of the family. So as the story progresses, these two mothers, Diana and Ruth, start to form a bit of a unique connection. Meanwhile, we have Grace there who's, shall we say, toying with her cousins in some dangerous ways. Couple that with her drug addiction, and the results end up being disastrous. Now, like we said at the beginning, you know, if you're like me, when you think about canon, you're thinking about breakdancing and ninjas and Chuck Norris and Charles Bronson, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. This movie is about as far from that as you can get. As a matter of fact, it was in competition at the Cannes Film Festival in 1987, and Barbara Hershey won the Best Actress Award at that festival for this film. And it did get some critical praise. I believe Roger Ebert had it on his list of the top movies of that year. But beyond that, the film was largely ignored. So, yeah, I'm going to let Austin get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Shy People.
Well, yeah, this is, like you said, very, very different from the you're Missing in Actions, your Invasion USAs, your Ninja 3, The Dominations. Very much on the opposite end of the canon spectrum. Something that canon did, and especially was really pushed by Menachem Golan, one of the two cousins that ran the company, was kind of the creative force behind it. He really, really pushed he craved critical respect. He wanted to make films that were films, I guess, not just exploitation. He kind of would bristle at that, even though these were the movies that really paid their bills and allowed them to make them. But he was always proud to tell journalists during interviews that if somebody wanted, say, the new Chuck Norris movie, if they wanted Missing in Action, a distributor in Italy, let's say, he would make them also take the John Cassavetes film he was producing at the time. Mm-hmm. And he took pride in getting films out there that were by what he considered to be these artful, important filmmakers. And this led to canon, you know, all while they're making, you know, their Chuck Norris, Charles Bronson, Michael Dudikoff movies on almost twice a year at a certain pace, they were also producing films by Robert Altman, Franco Zeffirelli, Barbette Schroeder, Liliana Cavani, just to name a few. And Andrei Konchalovsky was somebody who came into the canon fold kind of the same way. He really is somebody who had a fascinating career for me. He's still working. He's still actually putting out films that are being, you know, getting good attention. They're playing here in the United States, even though he's back in Russia now. But he had actually kind of come into the film industry through Andrei Tarkovsky, and he had co-written a few of Tarkovsky's films, Ivan's Childhood and Andrei Rublev, two notable ones. And he got into, from there, making his own films. And in 1979, he released Siberiad, which was this long, epic historical drama about Soviet history. And yeah, it's divided in four parts, just this very, very lengthy movie, but it won the grand prize at Cannes that year. And he decided after that, that after getting all this attention, that he had really done all he could within the Soviet film industry. Even though they were funding movies, these movies he would get to make, he knew they would be really subject to government censorship and things like that. He was very limited in sort of the subject matter he could explore. So with the encouragement of some of his friends he'd made at these film festivals, some very famous people, namely one of them being John Voight, Shirley MacLaine, Natasha Kinski being a couple of the friends that he had made that encouraged him to come stateside, he moved to Los Angeles. And well, that didn't go great for him for a couple of years. We were, you know, in the middle of the Cold War. The only Russians, Soviets involved with any sort of filmmaking were the bad guys you'd see in movies. They weren't they weren't making movies in Hollywood at the time. And he came to the U.S. even after being, you know, this USSR's most acclaimed filmmaker for that time, and not being able to make movies. He ended up for a while teaching basically as an assistant professor at, you know, community college in film. Meanwhile, he's still trying to work on projects and get them made. And it's very funny because he's out at lunch one day with Natasha Kinski, and Menachem Golan is at the same restaurant. And he spots her, of course. He's going to recognize her as an actress from probably Cat People at that time, being the early 80s. This would have been pre-Paris, Texas. And he walks up to her and starts doing the Menachem Golan thing and pitching, you know, well, you know, come join the Cannon family. What movie do you want to make? And well, she says, actually, I'm here with my friend Andre, who has a movie idea that I want to be in his movie. And Menachem turns around, what movie do you want to make? Tell me about it. And he starts describing this movie about a Yugoslavian veteran who comes home and has this image of this woman, this lost love that he left behind. And it's kind of altered in his head that he spent time as a prisoner of war and he's got a lot of PTSD, and it's kind of altered his image. He's got this very idealized image of this girl. And when he returns to her, he can't divorce this image from the reality of this girl that's been waiting for him to go off to war. And Menachem listens to this pitch. He looks at Natasha, who says she's going to do it. And he turns to Andre and says, fine, you do it. You shoot it in 3 months in Pennsylvania, and it's World War II veteran. And that became Maria's Lovers. So Andrei Konchalovsky went from spending all, you know, 3 years just trying to get somebody to take him seriously at the studios, and no one would, to over lunch, you know, within a space of 30 minutes, getting to shoot one of his dream projects in just in a few months from then. And it's fascinating because it did lead to Maria's Lovers and then Runaway Train being this fantastic, fantastic movie. Anybody who hasn't seen it, I highly recommend it.
Absolutely.
Adapted from a script by Akira Kurosawa. Whew, that was harder than it usually is to say. But yeah, this stupendous film that ended up earning Oscar nominations for John Voight and Eric Roberts that year. And it was really a movie that kind of opened a lot of doors for Cannon. After that, there were a lot of more serious filmmakers and directors filmmakers and stars coming to Cannon saying, hey, you know, I've got this project that no one else wants to spend money on, you know, will you do it? And Cannon's answer is usually yes, but for cheaper, you know, if you can do it for half as much money as you'd like. And a lot of them were willing to do it. A lot of interesting movies came out of that. But that's a very roundabout way of saying Shy People was something he had written years before, was originally set in Siberia, and he had written it, the Barbara Hershey role for Shirley MacLaine, who was a good friend of his. And through a long sort of circuitous path, and once it goes to the Cannon Ringer, Shirley is no longer interested, and it's now set in Louisiana. But it is a movie that, I guess the setting wasn't as important to him. You can kind of, it was this clash of cultures, the urban woman versus the, you know, very conservative rural person, just these two different sets of values coming in and clashing, and how that affects both of their respective families.
Well, it's really interesting that it wasn't initially intended for the Louisiana setting, because as I watched it, I thought that was one of the things that I thought was the most interesting and compelling about the film. Now, granted, I've always had a bit of an interest in that region of the country. I used to, when I traveled more regularly for work, I used to go to Lafayette on a somewhat regular basis, and always enjoyed just the environment and the culture and the people there, the food, the music, all that kind of stuff. Now, that's much different than going deep into the swamp like they do in this movie, of course. But still, I've always found it to be one of the most intriguing regions of our country. And you know, I guess as you were starting to tell the story a little bit about, you know, this filmmaker and you know, him coming to our country and struggling a bit to do what he wanted to do, and you know, then this encounter that gave him the opportunity and all that, I was starting to form a story in my head of, oh well, I guess he just became so intrigued with this unique part of America, you know, the Louisiana Bayou, and that inspired him to do that, but no, he actually had a different setting in mind when he wrote it. That blew me away there.
Well, when he wrote the initial story, I will say that he had some time. The script, the Louisiana version, I believe started coming together about 1984 when he first went and toured that area looking for locations. This is one that, even if he had not made it with canon, he wanted to tell, and he did want to adapt it to the U.S. So he had a little bit of time to kind of get to know the area and to retool it to, I should say, an American setting. I think because he probably knew that playing for American audiences and being an American film at that point, even though he was a Russian filmmaker with a French screenwriter and a very multinational group with Israeli producers, he knew that if the story could be told in a way that, you know, it was a more American point of view, that it would play better here.
I think that element with the setting is really effectively done. I mean, I've always enjoyed films where it's taking me someplace that I'm likely never going to get to visit myself. You know, just to be immersed in a world that is completely foreign to me. I find that to be really intriguing. And I really appreciated too that I think that the way that he approaches it in this film is very believable. And maybe part of that is the fact that he is not coming at it with some of the, let's say, stereotypes that we as Americans have in our minds. You know, so often in movies, when we see this type of a setting, it's presented in more of a cartoonish type of way. You know, there's almost a little bit of a silliness to it. And there's, you know, times where me as someone that spent my whole life living in the middle parts of the country, you know, I could watch movies a lot of times and go, well, the person that wrote that never stepped foot out of Los Angeles. You know what I mean?
Right.
It just seems like they don't know the setting that they're writing about or making a film about. And here, I think it's approached in a very honest and believable way. It's still otherworldly, you know, to someone like me that didn't grow up in an area like that. But it's still very believable.
I think he does approach the characters and this world in a very, I don't know if this is the right word, but a sympathetic way. I think he respects this area. I think he did come to really kind of have a true respect for the bayous and in this part of the country, something that, like you said, usually, and I think it's just a way that even we're almost trained to, or at least I can only speak for myself, but when you see this sort of setting in a movie, you expect Deliverance or Motel Hell or something like that, something a very scary type of setting. And even though there are things in this, like the first time we see the one brother, Tommy, he's locked up in a shed, and we see him just from a distance crying for help, and he's not really mentioned for a good course of the film. There are things that are kind of that sort of scary, but ultimately the film really doesn't go there. It doesn't dwell in that. It sort of just looks at these two women and their families from very different backgrounds, and sort of how the, both in their own ways, how they see the way they're raising their kids and the way they're living their lives being right, even though they can kind of learn something from each other.
Yeah, and I want to delve into that a bit more, but I want to jump back to what you were saying a moment ago about kind of the scariness or maybe the sinister vibe of the environment. And you're right, it doesn't dwell on that, but I do think that the way it's approached, the way it's photographed, certainly, and and maybe partnered as well with the Tangerine Dream score, there is definitely a somewhat of a horror movie quality to this.
Yes, and I think that I would think that might be something that Konchalovsky was consciously playing into. I think as an audience, we are conditioned to see a river. A boat going down a river with moss hanging down off of the trees and a fog rolling in, and our brains are automatically conditioned to start playing dueling banjos in our head, I think. That was something that he was probably aware of. And this is a movie that is beautifully, beautifully shot, for unfortunately only being available on VHS, and I believe Tubi has the Laserdisc transfer on it. But it is beautifully shot. It's Chris Menges, who had won 2 Academy Awards, his prior 2 films for Best Cinematography. He did Killing Fields and The Mission for Roland Joffe, and he had shot Local Hero right before that for Bill Forsyth. So he's a great cinematographer working on this, and really there's some cool lighting. There's a lot of great shots of these natural settings.
Yeah. I mean, the way they use, like, the trees that are coming out of the water and the mist that hangs over and all that. And, you know, it's one of those things where you're looking at these images that are so grimy, I guess is the way I want to describe it. And yet you're looking at it going, it's so beautiful. And there's moments where, and again, kind of going back to the horror type element of it, where I'm watching this and I'm going, I feel like my eyes are playing tricks on me like they would where if I was actually there. You know, there's this element of mystery that we didn't really hit on when we went through the story that, you know, is the family patriarch Joe really dead, or is he still out there and watching, you know? And there's moments of this film where it's constructed in such a way where you as the viewer are questioning yourself what you're seeing. And did I just see him? No, didn't know that it's just a tree. No, you know, it's very effectively done.
It is. This character of Joe, who Uncle Joe, who may or may not be alive, he definitely is a looming presence over every moment of this movie in a way that only you don't see much in film where someone's absence is, you know, is as strong as any character that's there on screen and interacting with the rest of the characters.
Well, I mean, because of so much of what makes up Barbara Hershey's character is based on her relationship with him. And we never see him, but we learn bits and pieces about their dynamic as things go on. And it's a bit terrifying. And, you know, just also the idea that, you know, as we learn more about him and the abusive nature of the relationship and all that, yet she holds him in such reverence. And, you know, there's this rather grotesque looking picture on the mantle, you know, this painting that, you know, is not pleasant to look at all. And there's this chair that stays empty all the time. It's his place at the table. In fact, one of my favorite scenes of the film is where Martha Plimpton sits in the chair, and then you basically have that moment of them telling her that that's Joe's spot, and it takes her a while to kind of get what they're saying, and you're almost to the point where, you know, by the time she realizes, you think they're going to hurt her if she doesn't move here, you know.
This painting that is this portrait of Joe, the family does keep it right over his chair at the dinner table, up on the mantle. You described it as it's off-putting, but if anyone who hasn't watched the movie but they know Mystery Science Theater 3000, it reminds me of the painting of the Master from Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Yes.
It's got that same energy to it, the same vibe.
Absolutely. Well, and I, you know, one of the things too, that just as we're seeing these scenes unfold, you know, the big element, of course, is just kind of this clashing or maybe even coming together of these two cultures. And it's interesting the way we watch this. And, well, what am I trying to say? Jill Clayburgh's character, the, you know, supposedly cultured, successful woman here, comes across as a much less pleasant character than Barbara Hershey's backwoods matriarch does.
Yeah, yeah, you come to sympathize more for a while with the mom who keeps her grown son locked up in a shed more than than Jill Clayburgh, who, yeah, she is very patronizing of this family. You really, you do come to, at least I can speak for myself, but to dislike her for a while by the way she kind of comes in here and is just using them as the, for this story. She is kind of, you get the sense, portraying them as freaks, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, they never come across that outside of the first moments that that Jill Clayburgh and Martha Plimpton step foot onto this island that they live on. You never get the sense that they're anything less than human. They're very rounded characters. They have a very backward, strange sense of belief, but they're human. They're very three-dimensional and interesting. Jill Clayburgh's character kind of does not treat them in that way, or it does not speak of them in that way. She's kind of there to come in and be the cultured, I don't know, it almost as a, like a colonizer or something in that sense. She's here to push the right culture, her culture, onto them.
Well, she even says that at one point. There's a scene where she's kind of pecking away at her typewriter and Martha Plimpton comes in and they're talking, and Jill Clayburgh says something along the lines of, you know, well, maybe we can straighten them out or be a good influence. I forget exactly what the wording was, but, you know, clearly, you know, she thinks that they're a bit backwards, and in some ways they are, certainly. But, you know, at the same time, Barbara Hershey's character, I think, is coming across as much more human than Jill Clayburgh's is. I mean, Jill Clayburgh's character is kind of all about putting up appearances, and you know, I mean, she goes out into the swamp and she's wearing these fancy clothes and heels and designer bag, and her nails are done, and she's got big gaudy jewelry on, and you're thinking, lady, don't you know where you are? You know, did you really think this was the way to dress to go out to the swamp? And you're just going, who are you trying to impress? You know, and it all just seems like a big act that she's putting on to try and come across as impressive. And meanwhile, you know, you've got Barbara Hershey's character, who is, you know, all about, you know, she's going to do whatever it takes to protect her family. And sometimes that means some very inappropriate things, but still, especially when you think back to the way that Clayburgh's character interacts with her daughter, who is doing drugs and sleeping with older men and stuff like that, and she does nothing about it, you're going, well, heck, Barbara Hershey's a better mom than she is.
You know? Yes. Yes. And that's, yeah, that, I think that's really the point that this movie is trying to make. Both these women are going about things in their own very wrong way, but they've also got a lot they can learn from each other. Whether that's being more of a strict mother, I guess, in Jill Clayburgh's Diana's place, and also just letting go a little bit, which is what Barbara Hershey's character needs to learn with her own sons, who she can't really really leave the house. That's where they're barely allowed to leave to go into town. There's no outside influence. They don't have TV. They don't have radio. Things like that. It's something that's interesting. Just in the same way that Joe, the family patriarch, is not present, and you're not sure whether he's alive or dead, or where he is, or what exactly happened to him. There's the older brother, Mike, who is talked about as if he is dead. And we learn very quickly that he's not. he just left the family, and he's been completely cut off. Really, he's as good as dead to her, which is something that her other sons, I think, is what keeps them at home, what they fear.
Yeah.
They don't want to lose everything they know just to learn a little bit more about what's out in the world.
Well, and it seems the oldest son's only crime is that he wanted to experience more. He wanted to go off to, I don't want to call it the city, I guess, you know, the town or whatever, you know, he's in this pretty small town running a strip club there, but yeah, I mean, it's not like his crimes were all that great. He just saw greater horizons, I guess. And there's a moment where he has a conversation with Jill Clayburgh because they go into the town for something, and there's an incident that happens in his strip club and whatnot. And, you know, there's an interesting moment of connection the two have there. It was wild for me just seeing Merritt Buttrick in that role. I mean, I, of course, always think of him from, you know, he was in Star Trek 2 and 3. He was Kirk's son in that. And I even remember him from the show Square Pegs. I go back far enough for that. And he just is almost unrecognizable from the way he looks there. He looks like Dean Stockwell almost.
You expect him to start singing into a light bulb.
Yeah, exactly.
Blue Velvet, his character from Blue Velvet, yeah. Yeah, it's something that relationship between this mother who is so fiercely protective of her sons and her other son who is the complete opposite. You know, she just stops short of spitting when saying his name. Mm-hmm. She's gone through. There's a great, absolutely a chilling moment that we see early on the film when she's kind of starting to warm up to, I suppose, this cousin, or I can't remember the exact relationship she is between Jill Clayburgh and herself.
Yeah, but it's complex. It's hard to keep track of.
Yeah. they're looking at a family photo and they're a family album, and they're looking through these old photos, these old black and white photos. And she's pointing out, like, this is my son here. This is, you know, me in this one. But every photo, there's a child whose face has just been scratched out. And we look through several pages in this moment, and before Jill Clayburgh's character finally brings it up, asks, like, do you mind who this is? And she really shuts that conversation down really quick. But it is a really, really kind of the way she regards her children as this almost sacred, too sacred to let go people, and this other son who she can't even look at photos of him. She won't even accept that, even though she knows she is alive. It's fascinating. It's really a really, really interesting. All the relationships in this movie are interesting, but that one in particular is one that kind of hangs in my head.
Well, and that scene, it is a great one. It's a standout scene because there is this interesting connection that Clayburgh and Hershey are starting to have, where even though they're coming from very different environments, these two ladies, these two mothers are starting to connect. They're enjoying looking at these old pictures. Clayburgh's fascinated with seeing these family members that she's never seen before. They're laughing with each other. They're having a good time. And then suddenly we start to see these pictures with the scratched out faces. And that brings me back to what I was saying before about the somewhat of a horror movie vibe that parts of this movie has. When that imagery started to show up, I was going, oh my, this is right out of a horror movie, you know?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And like you mentioned earlier, the Tangerine Dream soundtrack really, really kind of plays into this. It makes it feel like this almost supernatural, otherworldly, worldly setting. And they do something interesting, because the music that they have in the film when we're in the swamps, when we're around Ruth's home and her family, this like almost looks like an old hotel or a palace, something in the middle of the swamps.
Yeah.
It's this beautiful, again, like what would you expect, I think, from Tangerine Dream, this dreamlike, otherworldly synthesizer music that is, it does give it this sense of kind of horror, but also kind of ethereal, I guess, maybe is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah. Well, actually, the Tangerine Dream score, I mean, well, first of all, anytime you see that in the credits, you know, strap in, because there's going to be some interesting stuff. But it actually, some of the cues that they use there reminded me a lot of cues that they use for another film they scored this same year. One of my favorites, and the film that we talked about on the very first episode of this show, almost 200 episodes ago, 3 o'clock High. There's this ominous tones that they use there that they use quite a bit in 3 o'clock High, where they're kind of setting up the school bully character that's kind of at the center of that film. So, yeah, but I mean, yeah, it's Tangerine Dreams, so there's going to be some good stuff there. Let's talk a bit about the performances, and I guess maybe what you think of our key players, who stands out for you. I mean, Barbara Hershey got some love from Cannes for her performance here. So I guess, you know, who are your MVPs? What do you think of these performances?
I think Barbara Hershey was really fantastic. I also really liked Martha Plimpton in this.
I agree. Yeah.
She was someone, I mean, I've seen her in so many things since then, but at, you know, this time, probably, I think most people probably just seen her from the Goonies or known her from the Goonies. But she is really you could have had this character in here and just be this very, I guess, kind of flat, I want to say bad girl teenager. And she's not. She is there's a lot more to her than that. She is mischievous. She is very really, she fights against her mother and things like that. But she is somebody who's throughout this film, I think, really looking for a very simple sort of love that her mother has not been giving her, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she does that, I think, through this her mother's ex-boyfriend. We never get much of a explanation there, but this older parental figure who her mother kind of brings her on this trip to get her away from. But also, you know, she looks for this romantic love from, you know, her cousin in some way, yeah. Second cousin or something, it turns out.
Whatever it is, somebody, they're related, yes.
Again, yeah, not to get too deep into the ending, but there's a moment where they kind of, the mother and daughter, Ruth and Grace, have it out, and then there's just this hug. Joe Clayburg hugs her, and there's this embrace that's just like, oh wow, this is a moment where this is just something, this simple like hug, this simple like mom putting you in your place, you know, like just, you know, giving you some clear boundaries, telling you no for once, and
right.
then
yeah.
squeezing you, is that moment. It looks like something that she's been probably screaming for most of her adolescence, and if not her entire childhood.
Yeah. Well, that's the impression you get through this whole thing, is that, you know, Martha Plimpton's character is acting out, she's rebelling, but there's also these moments where it's almost like she's begging for her mother to stop her, to tell her no. And when you get to that moment at the end of the film where they finally have it out and the mom says no, you do almost get the impression like this is the first time she's ever had the courage to say that word to her daughter.
Yes.
And I think Martha Plimpton handles the whole thing wonderfully. You know, as you go throughout the film, like you say, she's this rebellious character. She's this mischievous character. It's one of those cases where you just see the wheel spinning. You know, she, you know, there's moments where she comes across as very sweet. And then there's other moments where she just goes, well, okay, then I'm going to seize on this moment and I'm going to do this thing that I really shouldn't do. But, you know, hey, you said I'm free, so I'm going to do this. It's a great performance. I would say this is probably one of the best performances I've seen from Martha Plimpton. I think she's the MVP here by far, not to take anything away from the others. I think Barbara Hershey is great here as well. I mean, I just, as I was watching it, I was at times having to remind myself that it was Barbara Hershey, because I'm thinking about it going, well, this is 87. You know, this is right around the time when I, as a teenager, would have started really noticing her in movies, you know, things like Hannah and Her Sisters or Hoosiers and that. And you watch this and you go, that can't be the same actress. She looks like she's been through the ringer here, which is, you know, fits for the character. I mean, she's had a hard life and all that. You know, she doesn't come across as the quite so glamorous figure that she does in some other films. And the way she kind of rules her family with an iron fist, I guess, is the way to put it. It's a very strong performance. And, you know, I don't know what she was up against at the film festival that year. But, you know, from what I see here, I think that's a deserving award.
Yeah, absolutely. Just the teeth. She has these teeth in there that are very dirtied up. They look like a woman who has lived in the swamps for 20 years, and that she's just it's an unglamorous, it's a very non-glamorous role. And something that I think is also worth kind of thinking about as you watch this movie is that it was shot in the bayous. It was shot in, you know, in the heat and the humidity and with the bugs. There's something, again, give credit to Martha Plimpton and Joel Clayburgh, but there is a part in this film where they end up in the swamp, and they would come out of there and they would spend, I think it was, they spent like 2 days shooting those scenes, and they were coming out with, you know, they'd dip in the water for a little bit, then pulled up into the boats after they got the shots, but they'd come up with leeches on their skin.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It was not a comfortable place to be shooting at all. And that, I think, just the dedication, because those are also very, very effective, riveting scenes.
I agree. That third act is really just a very visceral sequence. And the whole time you're watching it, you feel creeped out. You feel dirty. You're watching that going, yeah, I wouldn't want to be swimming around in that water. Who knows what's in there?
No, not at all.
Leeches probably being the least of your concerns. I'm thinking alligators and stuff, you know. It's
not a place I would want to go take a dip. Not at all. Before we move on, I just want to, something that strikes me as interesting about this movie is at the Cannes Film Festival that year, it was one of the best reviewed movies there, best reaction to it. There's a great book, if anybody is a fan of 80s art house cinema, but or especially of Roger Ebert. He wrote a book called 2 Weeks in the Midday Sun, and it was really basically a journal from the festival that year, because he had been covering it. I think it was his 20th one or something he'd covered, or 15th or something like that at that point. And so it's really a day-by-day breakdown of the 1987 festival, where he's going and he's interviewing everyone who was up for big awards, everybody, all these different filmmakers, directors. He talks about the parties he goes to, and there's several interviews with Menachem Golan in here, and there's several interviews with Barbara Hershey in that book, because he interviews her first, where he kind of has this not great interview with her. And then he interviews her after seeing this, and she's really excited to talk to him about it. But he interviews Menachem Golan, the head of Canon, several times throughout this. And Menachem keeps saying, this is our best chance this year. This is our best chance of actually winning an award as Canon. Like this movie, this and Barfly, the two films in competition, if it's ever going to happen for us, it's going to happen now. If it doesn't happen now, it's never going to happen. You get the sense that he really believes this is his last shot. And even though this is before Canon fully crumbled down as the house of cards, but he points out, because Menachem had served on juries, and he said, this is the 40th anniversary of the festival, and I think it's rigged. He says this well before the jury, anything happens. It's very early in the book. I think they're going to choose a French film, because 40 years, they'll want a French film to win. And Roger Ebert writes in the book, this was one of his favorite films of the year. This was his favorite film of the festival. And there's many other conversations in the book where he's saying, like, this is likely to win. And the movie that wins that year is not this one, even though people expected it to take home take on the palm. It's a movie called, gosh, Under the Son of Satan. It was the only French film in competition that year, and it's something that is just as forgotten as as this movie. And it's just interesting because there are interviews afterwards, and you can almost feel Menachem's sense of defeat. And Cannon really fell apart pretty fast after this. But you do feel that, I think this loss, this not getting the respect he'd been working, trying to get so much, not getting it here, I think he just gave up. It's kind of sad, but you get a sense that, you know, he just thinks it's never going to happen after that. The movie came out, and fortunately, Cannon really kind of botched the release and didn't support it, and it barely played in many places. They were not good with distributing their own art house films. I mean, Runaway Trains, it had been up for an Oscar nomination, and it was playing in a Kung Fu theater in New York City. That's how their distribution was. they were not good. They did not know what to do with a movie when it didn't have Chuck Norris or Michael Dudikoff in it, or Shokosuke. Well,
yeah, I mean, like I said, I had never heard of it before. And I mean, I was someone, you know, I mean, I was in high school, but I was one of those people that was, you know, checking the newspapers every week for what came out. I was in the video store every week seeing what new releases had happened. And unless my mind is just failing me, which is entirely possible at my age as well, but I have no memory of ever seeing this one before. And I am so glad you brought it up. I am totally on Team Ebert on this one. I actually pulled it up on YouTube. I was able to find a clip from the At the Movies with Siskel and Ebert show where they go through their top picks of the year, and Ebert includes this one and you know, just praises it all he can. And sitting right across the aisle from him there, Gene Siskel is basically like, yeah, I didn't like it as much. Shame on you, Gene.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Film Cast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hello, everyone. This is JD from the In Session Film Podcast. Each week, we review
the latest from Hollywood, California.
Well, yes, Brendan. We also
give top three lists.
Okay, yeah. Thanks again, Brendan. Additionally, you can hear us
talk other movie news, trailers, varying movie series, or other interesting film-related topics, and even rants and raves of the week.
That's correct, Brendan. On top of our main show, every Friday,
you can also hear our extra film podcasts.
Good job, Brendan.
Thank you, JD. It's my goal to make you proud. You're the father, after all.
Yes, and I'm very proud. You can listen to the In Session Film podcast on
iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or at InSessionFilm.com.
Brendan, will you please let me complete just one?
Nope.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Listen to the In Session Film podcast every Monday and Friday. Subscribe today and hear me verbally beat JD like a Cherokee drum.
No. That's not how this works, sir.
Hey,
no.
Go cry at Midnight Special again, okay? That's what you're good for.
I will. You know what? And I'll do it while pummeling you. I'll do both at the same time.
How are you going to pummel me?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
We've brought back those good old time flavors, and today they're better than ever. All these delicious treats are waiting for you at the refreshment stand. Delicious fresh popcorn, ice cold cola, tasting candy you know and love. They're all ready for you now, so you won't have to miss any of the feature. Come and get them.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie, something that we've enjoyed that we want to tell everybody else about. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, might be something new in theaters or on streaming. It could be anything. So, Austin, what is your recommendation?
Well, I am excited to talk about this movie. Last time I was on, I got to talk about my favorite new-to-me discovery of I believe it was 2021. So this was actually the last year's, my favorite new discovery of 2022. And that is 1988 or 87, depending on where you read and what you believe and where it was released. The film is called The Kid Brother. It was also released as Kenny in some places. You can probably find it on YouTube under either title if you were searching for it. But it is a Canadian film shot in basically the outskirts of Pittsburgh back in the mid-1980s. And it is really a endearing, just I absolutely fell in love with this film. Family drama. It's just about as heartfelt as you'll find out there. It is a film about this young man and his family. His name's Kenny. He is the youngest in a family with three children. Very poor family. And his most distinguishing trait, what you'll notice about first thing anybody notices about him, is that he was born with this rare condition where his spine basically was missing part, and he was born with severely underdeveloped lower half of his body. And so they, as a baby, his legs were amputated. He walks around sometimes. He gets around sometimes in a wheelchair, but mostly walks on his hand or on a skateboard, pushing himself with his hands. And the young man who played this role was also, his name is Kenny Easterday. He was basically playing a character that was based on him. He did have this rare condition. And his condition's so rare, his character in this film, that he, throughout his life at different points, documentary crews, film crews, TV crews have come in to, from all over the world, to basically do features on him. These sort of feel-good looks at people who are living either with disabilities or in different lifestyles and things like that. And his parents are both very loving parents, but trying to do the best they can with very limited resources. He has an older brother who is at home, just a couple years older than him, who really kind of looks after him and takes care of him. But you get the sense that he is maybe not jealous, but at least frustrated that he has this brother who needs all of this extra attention and gets all this extra attention with film crews and such coming in, that everybody knows his brother and they know him because he's different. And he's kind of living in his younger brother's shadow in that way. And where the film takes place, the story that we see, as a French Canadian crew comes in to shoot another one of these features on him. And Kenny's older sister, who's kind of estranged from the family, she's kind of like Martha Plimpton's character in the film we just discussed, but she's off living away from the family. She comes home because she apparently does this every time there's a crew in town, because it puts her on TV and she has aspirations of maybe becoming a model. And the whole family is kind of, you know, that frustrated with that that's the only time they see her. But he also just loves having his sister back. He very much loves her. He spends a lot of the film hanging out with her like ex-boyfriend, who he idolizes, who's this kind of like meathead jock guy who's always lifting weights, but also is like super nice to him, giving her rides in his car and stuff. And again, like that, I've done the best to summarize the movie there. What happens in it is really just all the family drama that comes into play as this crew arrives and kind of throws their normal family routine into chaos, even though it's kind of routine chaos. They've done this many times before, but just the drama that comes out of it. But it's really a sweet film. It's a look at a family that they have their problems, they have things, but they really do care for each other. And that is what the film is about. And it's fascinating in that it doesn't focus on his disability, even though that's the reason why this movie is happening. That's why the crew is here. You can forget in minutes into this film that your lead character is, you know, he's getting around on this, pushing around on himself around on a skateboard with his hands on the sidewalk and climbing around and things like that. He doesn't see himself as disabled. And because that's how he carries himself and how he acts and how he doesn't let anything stop him, it's very easy for the audience to for at least myself, but for the audience to forget that. Mm-hmm. It's again, I can't stress enough how heartwarming this movie was, and I was just amazingly, incredibly charmed by it. It kind of came out of nowhere and really knocked my socks off. I could go on and on and on, but I'm never going to do it justice in just how just endearing it was.
Well, this is a movie that I actually, I haven't seen it, but I did spot it recently because I think I was looking through a Letterboxd list of some sort and I saw this on there because the poster image is, you know, it grabs you for sure because it's absolutely, like you said, it's this kid with no lower half riding on a skateboard and you go, well, what's this? You know? And, and I remember seeing that there and looking it up a little bit and going, yeah, that looks pretty interesting. So I'll have to step things up and seek this one out a bit more.
Oh, absolutely. I recommend it.
All right. Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend is very, very different. You went for something heartwarming. I went for a pure exploitation film here because it came to mind as I was thinking about the Louisiana swamp where our main film was set. So my brain took me to 1974's Gator Bait, which is much more along the lines of the stuff we normally associate canon with, I guess. It's not a canon film. This is an independent film. It was directed by the husband and wife team of Ferd and Beverly Sebastian, who had their own kind of mini industry going, you know, writing and directing their own films. And this is probably one of the more famous ones. This film is about a poacher, a swamp girl named Desiree Thibodeau, played by Claudia Jennings, and she is always getting into trouble with the local police and all that. At the beginning of the film, there's a few police that she has an encounter with, and they try to assault her, but she escapes, and that leads to a chase, and during the chase, one of the cops accidentally shoots one of the other ones, and so, long story short, they create this you know, story that Desiree shot him, so then the sheriff and the posse all go out to get her, which leads to her family being killed, and then she is out for revenge. So we've got a swampsploitation revenge flick going on here. like Shy People, it, you know, it makes great use of the Louisiana swamp locales. I mean, for a low budget exploitation film, it's actually very well photographed and does a great job of just transporting you into that world. And I mean, also, I mean, again, low budget, but they do a great job with the action sequences. There's some really cool boat chases through the swamp and all that kind of stuff. But at the center of it all, you've got Claudia Jennings, and she is great in this movie. Now, she's you know, she's a great screen presence. She's this tough character. She's very beautiful, of course. And she's someone that was not primarily known as an actress. I mean, she basically became famous because she was Playmate of the Year, 1970. And then, of course, that led to some roles in some exploitation films. It was kind of funny when I watched this for the first time. I was like, oh, she looks so familiar to me. And then I realized that is because she is in the legendary Johnny Bravo episode of The Brady Bunch. So that must have been kind of wild. You know, you don't usually think of a Playboy Playmate being in an episode of The Brady Bunch, but that happened, I guess. unfortunately, she died very young. She died in a car crash at the age of 29. But this is, she's just great in this and really draws you in to this fun little exploitation film. You know, she's got a bunch of great backwoods bad guys to fight, and you know, it's just a fun swampy revenge flick.
I am sold. I need to see this.
There is actually a sequel too that came like 14 years later with another actress. I haven't watched that yet. I've got the DVD, haven't watched it yet, but we'll get to it. So anyway, Austin, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your books and all that good stuff.
Oh, well, my books can be found anywhere that fine books are sold, or on Amazon. That's the easiest place. But the Canon Film Guides, Volume 1 and 2. Volume 3 is in the works. I do not have a date yet, but it will get out there as soon as I am done. I'm having fun discovering a lot of these these movies that, to my pleasure, they actually have not been written about how much, many of them. So that's been a fun aspect. But I can be found on Facebook and Twitter, or X, if we're calling it that now, at Canon Film Guide, all one word on both sites. And yeah, I'm always sharing things, artifacts and treasures from the world of Golden Globus and Canon Films.
Excellent, excellent. Well, and when Volume 3 is out, definitely drop me a line. We'll make you the first stop on your book tour for sure.
So. Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for having me back. I had such a blast last time, and this was no different. Thank you for giving me somebody to talk to shy people about. This has been such a good time.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that's going to do it for this episode of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can find more reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch a few old movies.
Swamp makes a body see whatever they wants to see.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.